the bit of the diary that I've got, which I'll let you take away and have a look at.
I'd love to see that.
Yes, is 1960, and I think it's there was a bit when we were taken down to. This must have been, I think, just before my stepmother, when they actually got married, I'm not sure. But I'm sure she was in charge of us then, because we were taken down to Devonshire. And we had a holiday there with various Jones relations who were also taking their children down to Devonshire. You know, we also, there was a sort of colony, and I remember that with great pleasure, because we had a very nice summer holiday there. And there's quite a bit about that in this diary. And then there's coming back. And then she begins to talk about Cicely, who is my stepmother. And so she just doesn't write about him marrying her. I expect it was pretty wounding for her, really. But after that, she took a house, a furnished house. But I think, I always remember the house as Flackwell Heath, but I don't think that was the name of the village. But it was that, if you know where that is.
Yes, I don't actually know. Whereabouts is that?
Well, I think it's sort of northwest of London. It's kind of metro land, sort of.
Yes. Well, what's the name of it again?
Well, in my mind it sticks out as Flackwell Heath, but I'm not sure whether that was really the village or whether that was the name of the station that you got out at.
Yes, I don't know that at all. Yes. Anyway, it's northwest London.
Of London, yes, sort of in the country, you know, here.
Yes.
My father, of course, was right away at the time. I mean, he was actually fighting, you know. For a bit we went to Ireland because he was stationed there training gunners near Cork, and we had a bit of time there. I didn't like our being taken to Ireland because of submarines, but on the other hand it was considered to be a good place to be because there weren't any air raids, you know, Zeppelins or anything. But anyway, after that, the next, we were at Slough with my stepmother, and there we were for 2 years. We had a fairly long spell, or 18 months anyway. It always seems longer when you're a child. And that was towards the end of the war. And Ida used to come down and see us quite often, but had no responsibility for us.
May I just interrupt you? Yeah, how did she get on with your stepmother then?
Well, they were absolutely, you know, about as far apart as they could be. But she was always a very... I mean, for one thing, she had a tremendous family loyalty, and she would always have sort of bend over backwards to try and be on good terms with anybody who was related to anybody. I don't know if she possibly could. That was a very admirable trait in her character. She had no illusions about my stepmother. My stepmother was a most terrible liar. You know, she was a very attractive woman, but had a kind of extraordinary... Nobody ever could believe what she said.
Sort of romancer, really.
Yeah. Yes. Nobody ever really knew the story about her past, you see, of how she came to have gone in these, because we stayed with her parents in March, and they were... You know, it was a terrible little sort of... house with no mud guns at all near the railway down. And her father was a sort of old, very uneducated old countryman who drank. I mean, he wasn't a very excellent character, really. And I think it was all our relations found this a bit difficult. But Ida was the one who kept... she had a great sort of feeling that she was trying to keep people together, and she did sort of, you know, try and keep on good terms with everybody on each side and be a sort of peace influence.
You've got yourself to Slough anyway now.
Yes, well then, then my father came out of the army. The war ended and he came out of the army. And we had a house in Hampstead. There, of course, we were quite near my aunt. We saw quite a lot of her. And I started to, we both, I had a younger sister, this sister, you see, was born, my mother died, was just a short bit younger than me.
I see, she survived, right?
Yes, she did survive. Yes, we went to school in Hampstead. We lived at the top end of Hampstead, up near the heath, and Ida's house was at the bottom, in nearer to Primrose Hill. It was that part in the bottom of Hampstead. And then, I don't really know all the ins and outs of the health story, but then things got very difficult. My father got ill. I think he, in fact, I know, in fact, I mean, I myself. Make it better. He wanted to take us both out to Australia. And all the family weighed in with every sort of ounce of influence they had, both on his own side and also the in-laws. You see, my mother had had brothers and sisters who were very devoted to her, and they'd been helping my father with money and things because he was absolutely hopeless. He never could make a penny. And she didn't immediately spend and lose. And so I just said, well, she would take us again. And the brothers of my mother, the Carrolls, all said, yes, well, we'll help you financially if you will be responsible. We'll help with their education. Then my father popped off to Australia, and he wasn't there very long because that also was a failure. But at that point, we really did go back to live with my aunt, and she took charge of us. There was never an official adoption because she didn't feel that she could take her brother's children right away from him, officially, legally. You know, then there was one point at which it was considered, you know, whether she should apply for us to be made wards in Chancery so that we shouldn't go out to Australia. But anyway, my stepmother then fades out of the picture, really. I think my sister went on seeing her because she liked her. I didn't get on with her. My sister was a simpler character, not so intellectually inclined as I was, you know. Also, she was much more popular. I mean, my stepmother liked her much better, so they got on. Anyway, there we were. We then settled down in Hampstead, you see. Now, at that point, she really did have to give up her suffrage work and so on.
On your behalf, in a way, then?
Yes. And all her friends... Now, I think it was a very noble action, but I think it was also something that, in a way, she really wanted to do. I mean, I'm being quite honest about this. I admire her enormously, and everybody said she was really, it was so noble, her taking on these children. And in a way, it certainly was, and she had to go through great financial hardships to keep. And that certainly was not what she wanted to do. I mean, she had to do things like pot-boiling journalism and so on to make money, you know, and preventing her from doing real scholarly research, which she wanted to do. But actually leaving public life, I'm not at all sure that, in a way, she wasn't really quite relieved. I don't think she was really... I think she did all the committee work and so on, but I don't think she was... She really liked it very much. I think she was really cut out for that sort of public life because she had two very strong inclinations. One was towards personal relationships with individuals, which she was very good at. And another was towards sort of history, you know, as a scholarly discipline. I don't think actually sort of sitting on a lot of committees and raising money for women's votes and this sort of thing was really her cup of tea. So that in a sense, and also she had a very, very strong maternal instinct, but was not at all prepared to marry. Now this is a point that perhaps we should now mention, because this applied to quite a lot of the people she lived among. See, a lot of those women adopted children, or Royden adopted a child. She had two other friends. One was a person called Frieda Godfrey, who was headmistress of a big girls' school. Birmingham. And another was a Miss Davis, who certainly was headmistress of a school in Birmingham. They tended to be in the educational profession. And they all adopted children. They none of them really wanted to marry, you see. I mean, they really felt they couldn't enter into a marriage relationship. And I think this was because they felt really so strongly the sort of whole setup was wrong and degrading to women.
Yes.
As indeed I think it was. And I mean, she was also rather hung up about sex, I think. My aunt, like a lot of other women at that time.
Well, everybody was, in a way, by modern standards.
Well, quite, yes. Yes, but perhaps perhaps more so than others, because she, I remember she did once tell me when I was growing up, I was, you know, sort of thinking getting married myself, that she told me that she'd been had a most frightful sort of moral shock when some, she'd been sort of, you know, rather fancying some person, or he had her anyway, things had been going along in those lines, and a woman friend of hers had said something to her about sort of the double standard, you know, and said, of course you wouldn't expect your husband to be a virgin, why would she use that language? I mean, that was what it said, you know. And she, this to her was a terrible moral shock, because she never really occurred to her this wouldn't be so. The men had a different standard. And I think this may have been one of the things that put her back against marriage. She certainly thought that herself, because she said so to me.
Presumably reinforced by knowing about your father's setup.
Yes, yes, very much so, yes. So that I think in a way, you see, by taking us, it was a great thing to have done, and I'm entirely grateful for being rescued from the life I would have had with my stepmother. But she was satisfying something in the only way that she could, which was to have children without having to have a husband.
Yes, well, that's absolutely, I mean, human motives are always mixed.
Yes,
exactly. I mean, I don't think it's any discredit on her to say that
she
was human like anybody else.
No, of course it's just not, no.
That's very interesting.
And I think that is very, very, that is, was certainly so. Now, undoubtedly, the one adverse effect on me, I mean, we had I loved her very, very dearly. We had one, the one adverse effect on my life was that she decided that I was going to do all things that she hadn't been able to do. You know. In point of fact, I got married immediately after coming down from Oxford because I used to have quite a large family of children. It's bad luck. It's the sort of thing you might expect.
What sort of ambitions did she want to realise through you then? Intellectual ambitions, weren't they?
Oh, well, I must go to Oxford. I must get a first. I did go to Oxford. I didn't get a first. I got a second. Then I must have a career. You see, I must be a professional woman. In a way, it was partly her fault that I got married so young, because, in the course of her, she was very attracted towards young men and women, because she was a very good listener, very sympathetic, you know, she had great powers of empathy with people. And there was a curate, the young curate whom eventually I married, was really her friend, I mean, he came to the house. And, you know, he was like sort of son to her.
How heavily did she bring pressure to bear on you? I mean, did you feel that this was really rather a burden on you, or was it just that you knew in the back of your mind that she would prefer you to do certain things, but it wasn't forced on you?
No, it was rather a burden. She tried very hard not to force it on me, but it was a little bit of a burden in a way too, because of the relationship was a bit of a strain, because I mean, having terribly high expectations of me, which I was always having to live up to, I grew up with a fairly hefty sense of guilt, which Barbara would say that I've never been able to throw off. she was so keen on the idea that the actual physical relationship of motherhood was not really very important. The important thing was the love you felt for people and what you created. And I think one of the things she failed to recognize was the fact that, of course, we were very close genetically. So, I mean, she had got a start for that, because some of her other friends who had this same view didn't really succeed at all with their adopted daughters. I mean, they weren't very satisfactory.
Yes.
She was lucky, but in a way, because, I mean, of course, I was address this in a sort of way. One of the things that I think she failed to recognise, which was really her grief, and I, as I grew older, I became a little more conscious of it, but probably she didn't let me write it, but I probably didn't know about it. It was kind of sort of in the background, but I certainly wasn't conscious of it when I was adolescent. She didn't really have the kind of natural instinct which a normal parent fortunately does have, that you've got to let your offspring grow and go. Because, I mean, although I know a lot of women aren't like that, a lot of mothers are very possessive, but basically most normal parents have kind of knowledge that they've got to kick them out at a certain point, or acquiesce in their taking themselves off. And of course, you see, if you've got a husband anyway to care about, I mean, that relationship, the relationship with any one of the children is not the dominant one. But when you have no husband and have never had one, and you put all your eggs in one basket, she her feelings were absolutely genuine, so she wanted me to be happy, and when she realized that to be happy for me meant marrying the man I'd fallen very violently in love with, and he was entirely suitable, I mean, from every point of view, she was perfectly prepared. She never put anything in her way. But she did let me see, against her will, that she didn't want to do this, but I mean, I was a fairly perceptive girl, young woman, and she did let me see that it was a very, very hard blow to her.
Because she had ambitions for him, because she wanted your companionship.
She wanted my companionship, she didn't want to part from me, and also she had ambitions. There were two things, and it was the companionship that was the worst.
So how did your relationship work out then after that? Did you try and straddle two horses, or...?
I did rather. You see, I met my husband much too young. I mean, I got involved emotionally with my husband much too young. I was still at school. I was 17. And he was a very patient man. I mean, he was, in a way, he was too good. I mean, he was very, had a terrifically strong sense of duty and was very iron self-control and was incredibly patient. And when he had made up his mind that he was going to marry me and no other girl, he just sat down and waited. And he waited 6 years. Before we actually got married.
Somehow,
I'm thinking
all now.
Yes, that's And during all that time, we often laughed about it later in life. You know, she used to be sort of saying things like, you know, you must remember that she's going to be 4 years at Oxford and then perhaps a year in Greece, you know. Well, she kept on telling him, well, don't you think you'd better go marry someone else because of all this, you see. But I mean, it was taking that
she liked him, nonetheless, didn't
she? She liked him very much. She loved him dearly. And, I mean, their relationship was, in some ways, after we got married, their relationship was really rather better than mine was, because I had to make an awful effort to cut the umbilical cord, you see. I mean, I had to. We had one or two rows, which I, of course, handled very neatly, and I probably was very selfish, but I mean, I had to make her see that I wasn't her home daughter anymore, and that she couldn't just go on exactly as we were before, but having my husband sort of as an appendage.
Oh, that's absolutely right. So, how did you handle the situation after that? I mean, was she just the person who visited, or who you visited occasionally, or was it closer than that?
Well, I think it was close to that. We wrote a lot and we saw a lot of her. But, you see, it didn't last very long because she died in 1939. We were married in 1935. Well, during those 4 years, we'd come to her much better. After my first child was born, things got very much better. As a matter of fact, I had a rather serious illness between my two children. Two elder children I had, and was really given up at one point by the doctors, you know, and this brought her very much more closely together with my husband, and she was very devoted to the grandson. I mean, you know, she would have preferred him to the big girl. At any rate, that made things much easier, and then as she was getting more ill and towards her death. You see, she had cancer and it was a very long business, yes. She went about and did things for ages, but it was gradually getting worse. That was very sad because that was partly, I mean, I just slightly blame feminism for that, because one of the people she tremendously admired was Dame Mary Shirley.
Oh yes, the doctor.
The doctor. And she became a patient of hers. We all were, in fact. And Dame Mary was very fond of her and was very good to her. I mean, used to do things for no charge and all sorts of things, long before the National Health Service. I mean, really, she was very good, generous towards her. But the fact of the matter was, I now think that Dame Mary Shirley was getting very old and really had lost a lot of her skill and hadn't kept up with sort of modern techniques and things. And I think it's unquestionable that when my aunt first developed cancer, which was quite a lot before, which was some time before I got married, it was sort of about 1932, I think, or no, earlier than that, even, no, about 1928 was the first. She had breast cancer. And if that had been properly dealt with a proper mastectomy and everything on the spot, I don't see any reason why she shouldn't have really survived much longer. I mean, there would have possibly even been completely cured. But then
even in those days, you think?
Even in those days, Dame Mary fiddled about and did a partial operation. And then, of course, some second was developed. I mean, they may have developed anyway. I may be unfair to Dame Mary, but yeah. I did rather feel. I know that later on she was on to Louisa Martindale, another great feminist doctor. She was the person who helped to found that hospital in Brighton for women, you know, the new Sussex
hospital. I've heard the name. Yes.
Well, she took over now later on after Dame Mary died, and I know she thought that it had been mismanaged, you know, that she could have done more for her. And she was very obstinate about medical treatment. I don't quite know why. She was very much inclined to think she knew better than doctors. Curious, because in many ways she had a good deal of Christian humility, but about medical things, she could be very stubborn. She was a very bad patient.
Was she as a kind of had believed in vegetarianism and health cures and things like that, and was it that?
She was never a vegetarian or anything in the diet line. She loved good food, but she was rather attracted to things like Kuhism, for instance. That was a great thing at one point. I remember being
What's that?
Kui was this man who used autosuggestion a great deal to try and cure people.
How do you spell the name?
Coué, C-O-U-E, with an accent, it's a French, he was a Frenchman. But they used to do, Coué enthusiasts used to, you know, every day and everywhere, I'm getting better and better, you know. That's
right. Oh, I know, yes. Sort of self-convincing yourself.
Yes, what a suggestion it's called.
Yes, I see. Because there's very good reason for women being suspicious of male doctors, but obviously not female ones.
No, well, you see, I think one of the reasons why she was determined to have Dame Mary was because she was a woman and a pioneer. In fact, later on, after she died, we all had her son, who was a man, but he was just an ordinary GP. I mean, he never attempted to do operations on people. But I think, I don't know. Anyway, in a way, you know, it was a mercy that she died, when she did, because I don't really think she would have been able to endure the war. She was... The first war upset her terribly. And then she did get very involved. She didn't actually join Lord Royden's peace army, but she was very mixed up with that and Dick Shepherd and all that. Disarmament and peace pledge union and all that, you see. And also, you know, League of Nations unions and what they're, you know. And I think the Second World War, with all the horrors and things, would really emotionally have been...
Was she on the left, actually, Mrs. Dalloway? Was she a Labour supporter?
Yes, she did vote Labour. She certainly voted Labour when Ramsay MacDonald's government got in, you know.
Did she?
Yes.
29, yes.
29.
Yes. What about 1931, the national government? Maybe it's difficult for you to was a test in 1931, if you were Labour or not, I think.
I don't really remember. I wasn't taking any interest in politics myself, and therefore... Also, another thing was, of course, that in our constituency, you could sort of... There was absolutely no hope of getting anybody except the Conservative Union, who had been in for ages and just held the seat forever, you know. I mean, I think basically she was really a liberal in politics, an old-fashioned liberal, yes. But she voted Labour because she had very strong feeling about social justice. And, of course, this all tied in with her friendship with the Hammonds, you know. She felt terribly strongly about social justice, not merely between men and women, but between classes and so on.
Could you say a bit more about her friendship with Barbara Hammond? I mean, it started at LMH, and what did they have in common then, do you think?
Well, I think a great feeling for history, and also a great passion for social justice, you see. I mean, she was very devoted to both the Hammonds and used to go and stay there quite often they were living in Hemel Hempstead, you know. And they were very fond of her. This was a real passion with her. I mean, justice was a passion, loyalty was a passion, almost too much. I mean, in a way, she was rather unrealistic about people. And when you were her friend or her relation, although she was quite a shrewd enough person to know when people were bad or so on, and she felt very guilty herself when people she loved did wrong, she wouldn't have it admitted. I mean, she had the sort of Victorian reticence that you never talk about. I mean, she would never have let on about my father, actually, because at the time when all that happened, we were given treatment against how inheritance was, and nobody knew what this was. I mean, children don't, they just think something's wrong, you have to go to the doctor's and awful bore, and it's rather painful. And Dame Mary managed the whole thing for her. But in fact, I never knew about this until just before I was getting married. Miss Martindale, who she then was under, she said, by the way, has your niece had another Vassman test? You know, she ought to have one before she's... Although, of course, I had perfectly clear ones when I was a child, but she said, to be on the same side. Miss Martindale was rather... venereal disease was rather her thing, you know, it was from the thing she was particularly interested in. And so she had to tell me, and poor darling, she didn't really want to. And also she thought it wasn't really very fair on my husband. I remember we were practically on the verge of getting married when all this came out, you know. It was perfectly all right, you know, so that was okay. I don't think it was right with my sister. I mean, in the end, I think my sister died of this. My father certainly did, because he died of GPI. You see, my father, after my aunt had... after she'd taken us over, my father still kept on coming time to time. He didn't live with us, and he didn't support us in any way financially. But while she was alive, he kept on coming, and I don't know what his private relations with women were then, but after she died, he took up with another woman whom he lived with, without marrying her, because my stepmother was still alive. And that again I didn't know about at the time. He told me afterwards, for some reason, I forget now, I was all annoyed at the time when he told me. I think he was wanting me to help him. But, Colin and I did have to help him quite a lot. And in the end, he was always sad. He died in the hospital, and it turned out that he had, in fact, person in Ghosts. I mean, it was Joseph's.
He died sort of some time after your aunt,
yes,
did he?
Yes,
and so
yes.
She never saw that side, that part of it.
She didn't see that part of it, and she didn't know about this. You see, I think that would have been very upsetting for her to have discovered about that. She really would have minded terribly about that, because she was. was somebody else's wife. The Loratadine came in there, and I mean, she would have felt that he'd really betrayed the people. She was the wife of the man in whose house he was living, as a lodger. I was all very sordid. My father was not a nice person. That would have upset her terribly. I mean, she would have been incredibly upset by that. On the other hand, up to the time while she was still alive, in spite of the fact that he had in a sense deserted us, and that he'd deserted his wife, and that he'd behaved in such an immoral way that he'd contracted this disease and therefore put on a pretty nasty inheritance, possibly. And all those things, you know, at the same time he was her brother, and she took the line that if I that I would have to help him when I was grown up, and Colin, my husband, you know, we'd all have to sort of rally round. And that was another occasion when we had a great argument, because I remember it so clearly. I said to her, "You mean you're telling me that just because he's my father, although he's not behaved to me like a father, I might have to give him money and look after him and so on, which, properly speaking, I would belong to my own children, you know, or Colin and my children." And she said, "Oh, yes." She had this sort of Charlotte Yang thing about parents, you see, that, you know, and family. In fact, of course, that was another thing which I didn't really do very much about. But I did try and sort of sort him out as far as I could when he got in difficulties.
But as far as you were concerned, she was entirely loyal to her brother all the time.
Yes, she had to skate over the fact that he... I mean, she always had to... she tried not to make us judge him harshly. It was impossible, really, because, I mean, obviously we felt terribly deserted. I mean, it was incredible, really, as children. You see, first of all, my mother had died when I was a baby. I mean, I'd been abandoned. Although nowadays, one would be considered to be absolutely a sort of case, you know, psychologist. But having rescued us both from all that, she still was always ready for my father to come whenever he wanted to, as long as he didn't interfere with what was happening to us, you know. And she was supported in this, you see, by my mother's brothers, because if they hadn't supported her and backed her up in the whole of this, she couldn't have done it from the point of view of finance, because she'd been relying on sort of inherited capital, which her family had left her, and it was all lost in the great crash of Armstrong. Whitley in Newcastle Furniture in the Depression, you know. And she lost almost everything. So after that she had all kinds of straits. I mean, she had this rather large house which was still
the Oxford house,
isn't it? No, this is Hampstead house.
Yes,
it was Hampstead. And so we had lodgers in the top floor, and there's one room on the ground floor was let as a studio, and we were all rather squashed in, because she still had two sons. You see, she had that was another thing. You see, she couldn't do anything. I mean, she'd been brought up. She had a personal maid until she went to live on her own after her father died. She didn't even know how to do her hair when she was a girl. She had very beautiful long hair. She was known at school as Mrs. Allen's hair restorer, because she had this mark on long chestnut tresses. Then she still couldn't. She'd never cooked, and she never boiled an egg in her life. You know. She learnt with great difficulty to sort of do a few very, very minor sewing repairs, like sewing on a button or darning a stocking, you know, in order to try and make herself a bit more independent. But she always had a housekeeper who did the shopping and the cooking, and one other maid in the house. And they became kind of, there again, this was all part of the sort of old tradition, they became part of the family. I mean, they were, even if she couldn't afford to pay them, she couldn't not have them, because, I mean, the reasons why they needed, I mean, the housekeeper was a woman whose husband had left her with, and although time I remember them, her children were all there, and even though she hadn't got anywhere else to live and so on, she couldn't have been sacked. I mean, really, she wasn't dependent in that sense. And the maids were much and much, they were apt to be that sort of person, you know. So that they were...
not just an employee-employer relationship.
No, it wasn't at all. It was a real family thing. But my mother had three brothers, you see, who were two of them. Well, one of them wasn't married, the youngest, and he contributed very generously to our education and went on contributing to my sister. Even after I was married, he went on contributing to my sister. Then another one did also help, and then the husband of her sister helped from time to time. They all rallied around when they could. They were fairly well off. They were in business quite well. You know. They weren't rich, but I mean, they had some money that they could afford to do this, and they were very generous. And then the rest of the thing she did, as I say, she did a great deal of sort of hack writing. I mean, she one of the things she used to do was she did a tremendous great sort of omnibus review of children's books for the Times Literary Supplement just before Christmas. And I remember the whole house used to be, it was marvellous for us, of course, because we got them all to read. The whole house used to be full of sort of Angela Brazil and things like that, you know. Just before Christmas, pile up all over everything. And she used to write a long article about them, pick them up. And she did various little jobs for papers. And there was one time when there was a paper called the Westminster Gazette.
Oh, yes.
Which was running some kind of, I think it was running some sort of charitable scheme, but quite where the money was coming from or why the Westminster Gazette was running it, I never really discovered, but I know it involved going, she did interviewing for them, you know, she went round and sort of saw people and wrote accounts of whether they should receive money or not, I suppose, you know, it was a kind of sort of social work,
yes.
Sort of, could now be done from an office.
So in some ways she's quite an old-fashioned Victorian person in the sense of involvement in social work, not having a proper career, not being able to do domestic work.
Yes, in many ways.
Rather Victorian in her outlook in a way. I mean, very idealistic, very...
she wasn't that way, but she wasn't in other ways. You see, she was very advanced in some things. I mean, one of the things, for instance, although I told you she was a bit hung up about sex, she had a very strong feeling that children should be properly instructed, you know, and I remember going tediously through some awful little book, starting with the butterfly and the bees, you know, went on to marry with her, which I'm sure she didn't enjoy at all, but felt it was the right thing to do. And when, as far as my education was concerned, you see, she was determined that I should have, and I went to St. Paul's Girls' School, which was quite an advanced school in some ways, you know, it wasn't at all old fashioned.
You didn't, incidentally, while I mentioned it, go with Diana Hopkinson, did you?
Yes, I did, yes.
Did you really?
She knew Mrs. Hubbard quite well, and we used to spend holidays, you know, that those holidays in Cornwall that Alice describes. Well, I was in
part of that context,
yes.
I could.
Yes, yes.
Do you remember Eva Hubbard?
Yes, I do.
Yes. Really? Because another person interests me a great deal.
I never really... you won't be shocked if I tell you this, but Eva Hubbard was the first grown-up woman I ever saw naked. I remember being extremely surprised.
She was a terrific outdoor person, always swimming at things.
Yes, it was on the beach at Cornwall, isn't it?
Yes.
And I was very surprised.
What sort of person was she, actually, do you remember her as? I mean, Eva, that is.
I don't really have an awfully strong concept of her, really.
She was very maternal, motherly sort of
She
figure.
Was nice. She was very good to children, yes. I mean, she was very good at play. I do remember that she used to make the thing's great fun, you know, with us. We had a... But the thing is that, you see, when we went to these holidays, I mean, they had a governess, and it was more... I don't know what Eva was doing or what her work was, I didn't really know. But I mean, you see, when we were there, we'd see an awful lot of her, except, you know, she would come down and bathe. And I remember she wanted to teach me to swim, and I wasn't very good at it. She wanted to take me on her, leaning on her back out to sea, and one of those goes, and Ida wouldn't let me. I think she was quite frantic, because I'm sure I'd have fallen off. But that sort of thing, she encouraged us to get up little plays and things together, you know, and act and have fun. But as far as our day-to-day sort of being looked after was, it was much more this governess that we were.
I see, yes. That's very interesting. And you know, Ida did actually know Eva Hummer quite well, didn't
she? Yes, she did.
They got on well together.
I think so, yes.
Because they're both, well, certainly Eva is a key figure in the whole.
Yes. Don't think she was quite as fond of her as she was of, for instance, Frieda Godfrey. We had several holidays with her, but I don't think she was so much involved on the organisational side. She was much more involved in education.
Yes, yes, I haven't come across her, actually. What about the Anna Rathbone?
Yes, she knew her slightly. I don't think she was ever very close to her.
No. Mary Stocks.
Yes, Mary Stocks she was fond of. I do remember. See, all these people used to come to the house, I mean, in Steeles Road when I was a girl. They were always dropping in and out. I mean, Miss Rathbone's only came home once, though I think she probably just came to a fairly formal meal, you know. Mary Stocks, the same. Miss Royden, of course, was in and out quite a bit, you know, more often. We saw more of them, because... until the business happened with Hudson Shaw. Mm-hmm. They had a bit of a break in their relationship because I had a dispute. Pippa once saw... well, that was more when I used to be taken to things, you know. I mean, I used to be taken along to meetings or on mud marches or sell flags, you know, to sell lamps and Florence Nightingale's birthday, that kind of thing, to raise money. But Ray, of course, we saw a good deal of, because she was always very nice to me, and she was fond of Ida, and I think in many ways she was very detached about people, and she, I think, had a sort of feeling for me that I could, perhaps in a way I was being, there was this sense about too much being expected of me, you know, and she... When we had holidays, we used to go and stay at Mud House.
Oh, yes.
With Barbara. So I first met Barbara in the first period when I was in Hampstead, when they were living in Hampstead too, but right up on the heath. And we were both almost babies. I only just vaguely remember being in that house and being, there was a little girl called Barbara that I was supposed to play with, and I think we didn't really like each other. Then later on, when I was with my aunt permanently from the 1921 or two onwards, we went to quite often and had holidays at Fernhurst. You know, and then we had, Barbara and I had a sort of love-hate relationship in those days. I mean, on the whole, much more love, but occasionally.
Most children again.
Yes, quite. And then there was a bit when I didn't see her at all, when she went away to boarding school. And I was at school, I was very involved with my friends there. Then we met again at MMH. But during all that time, my aunt and Ray were still on very friendly terms. And Ray used to do very kind things when she used to do things like giving me pocket money and so on. She knew how hard up we were. She was a very nice person.
Yes, can you tell me a bit about Ray? I mean, just another view of Ray would interest me a lot, because I don't come across many people who know her or knew her. Well, how does she strike you in your recollection of her? Because she died in 1940, didn't she? So you must...
Yes.
You've only got young woman's or childhood recollections of her, I suppose, haven't you?
I admired her very much, you know, and I had a great feeling for her. She was a person I liked to be with. Partly because she had... you felt she had a very great tolerance, that she was very detached about people, and therefore she wasn't expecting... I mean, if one behaved badly by her standards, she didn't appear to be shocked. I mean, she might express disapproval quite
wasn't the moral pressure.
But there wasn't the moral pressure. You know, so that she, it was very relaxing being with her. And the sort of things that she did was so different. I mean, we had, she did things like sort of building a house, and we were allowed to help. And I mean, having lived in this slightly rarefied hothouse atmosphere, nothing but books and high moral tone and so on, it was rather, it was very relaxing being at Mudd and being allowed to mess about. And she was, one or two things, she tried to toughen me up, which I think was really a forlorn hope. I mean, she was always sort of encouraging me to do things like climbing trees, not really quite realizing the fact I had very, very bad vertigo and simply couldn't, you know. But I was a rather delicate, mopsy sort of child, you know. I don't think Ray, sort of thought that I ought to be kind of toughened up a bit and tried from time to time, but she didn't do it unpleasantly. I mean, she didn't do it too violently, you know, so that one still liked being there and joining. And she did really, I think she did encourage my friendship with Barbara, which is odd in a way, really, because in some ways she and Ida were so different, and yet they were, they had a great mutual respect and affection for each other.
Because they both wrote quite a lot for the press, didn't they? I mean, they were both women who were earning their money by their pen, yes, to some extent.
Yes. Yes, they were.
We didn't actually finish off about money, really. Your aunt was really dependent on a legacy or on inherited money until the collapse, and then she had to rely, A, on your mother's relatives for your support, so to speak,
yes,
and her own skills for journalism for her own support. Is
yes,
that right?
And things like letting rooms in
letting
the house
rooms,
and that sort of thing.
So money was always scarce by middle class standards, really, is that really what you're saying?
Yes, it was.
Not in the absolute sense, but...
Yes. Yes, it was always scarce, although, as I say, we always had two maids, but that was just, you see, I mean, she'd been obviously been brought up in a situation where we had four or five.
So that was a come-down.
So it was a come-down, yes. But she was very unworldly about that sort of thing. I mean, she didn't... the fact that she had, she only didn't like doing, she only felt that doing domestic things was rather degrading for people who could do something much better. I mean, she never tried to stop my sister, for instance, from going, doing a domestic science course. And my sister was rather deaf and very early on betrayed certain failures of sort of, certainly of intellect and a certain amount of difficult of character. She was curious. She, as a little girl, she was fascinating and adored by everybody. But as she grew older, the inherited troubles that she'd had made life much more difficult for her. And she was extremely deaf and could never have done a kind of academic career of any sort. But my aunt took an endless trouble, although this was not her field at all, in sort of trying to fix her up with the kind of things that she could do. And she always tended to have friends of a lower social class because they were easier for her to get on with, you see. They weren't so well educated. And my aunt never tried to stop this. I mean, she was very, very understanding about that situation.
What about looks, Mrs. Dunlop? What did your aunt look like, actually?
Yes, well, as a girl, I think she was rather beautiful. She had this marvellous hair, you know. She had a very, there's a portrait of her as a little girl.
Oh, it's lovely.
Quite a lot of hair in there, rather arched eyebrows. Rather sloping shoulders. She got, she had rather good figure when she was young, but as when she got older, she got rather too plump, you know, became rather sort of shapeless in a way.
But despite her longish nose and all that, the reason for her not marrying was certainly not lack of attractiveness, I judge from those.
Oh, no, no, I don't think so. No, I'm sure she had suitors, but...
just from inside her, really.
Yes, it was from inside her. And she could be friends with men. You see, she was real friends with my husband, and she didn't. She wasn't at all anti-men in the sense that, in the kind of way that some modern women's slippers are.
No.
She just regarded them as being, in a bad way, poor thing. devoted to her father and her grandfather. I mean, no one could say that she was anti me. She wasn't against them. And she had a very good relationship with these brothers and my mother. They were quite, particularly the youngest one, the one who wasn't married. I mean, they used to exchange letters about books and things because he was rather culturally isolated, living in Lima, and she used to send him out books. He used to send her money and say, you know, get the latest biographies and so on. And she used to choose things and send them out. And they would write to each other about them. I haven't any, unfortunately.
She, another way in which she's rather Victorian in the sense she must have spent a lot of time writing letters.
Oh, yes, that's another thing. She was sort of family post office. She went on writing letters. And our house in Hampstead was a meeting place of all generations of family. And this is a thing that I missed awfully after she died, because I completely lost touch with some of my relations. And I realised then that it was because I hadn't got her, that she was the link, you see. I mean, for instance, her father's elder brother, so maybe the one who was a lawyer, by this time he had retired from the Foreign Legal Service and come home and lived at Danton House near Oxford, Cuddesdon, with his wife and some of his children, grown-up children. No, I think only one by then. His daughter didn't marry. The others were all married in a way. But he had his grandchildren and his niece, great-nieces, which was me and my sister, you see, to stay very often out there with Aunt Ida. And he was fond of her, and she, because he had been absolutely devoted to her father. I mean, there was an extraordinary relationship between the two brothers as children. And I've got a very fascinating thing he wrote about my grandfather as a child, which I'm now laboriously transcribing, because I feel that nobody will ever bother to read the writing, you know, so I'm having my entire beat out with two fingers. So she had him, and she had these, and Lawrence Hammond, you see, she was friendly with. Mostly her friends were women.
Quite a lot of them LMH women.
Yes.
Feminist women. Anyway.
Oh, and they were nearly all feminist women. I don't really remember her being friends. We used sometimes to pick up much younger women who perhaps weren't particularly interested, who had careers on holidays abroad, because one of the things was, you see, that in those days, strange as it may seem, it was really cheaper to keep four people in Switzerland or some parts of France for the summer holidays than it was to stay at home. And in order to let the maids also have some time, or, you know, have holidays and go away and that, we used to go abroad for quite long periods. I mean, you know, sometimes as long as 6 weeks. In the long school holiday. And we would stay in one place. We didn't move about because that was too expensive. We would go out for the cheapest way, you know, travelling second class, sitting up all night, and then stay in a hotel where you could stay for 10 shillings a day, which you could.
Yes, of course, that's again, but it does take you back at the park.
Yes, and then we would sort of sit down there. Well, then we, very often we met, sort of. I remember we had, she would pick up sort of stray young women very often who got attracted to her. Or didn't think we ever picked up any men on those sorts. I think it was always women, but who would sort of keep up with her a certain amount and come and see her. And her sort of younger cousins, the younger generation of the Joneses and the younger generation of the O'Malleys, were all very fond of her and used to come and stay and come and visit her.
What was the secret of this attraction she has for so many people? I mean, it's partly a great kindness, I suppose, isn't it? As you say, capacity to listen.
Extraordinary power of sort of throwing herself into people's minds, I think, you know, into their sort of situations and kind of empathy. I mean, she really did do that with all sorts of different sorts of people, even sometimes I think she rather romanticised them. I mean, maybe she wasn't always absolutely realistic about people. I mean, I used to think sometimes that she was taken in. I don't think she was imposed upon. I don't remember her.
But she presumably encouraged people to be at their best because she...
Yes, she did, because she expected the best. And this did produce. Then, you see, the people who stayed in the house got very fond of her, too. The people who she had as lodgers got very attached to her. She was a very remarkable... I mean, you see, people were so different. I mean, people were straight. She was miles away from her in many ways, except in their interests. I mean, as a personality.
Yes, tell me about Pippa, actually, because you know a person who interests me a lot. Can you remember her at all? I mean, as a person?
Oh, yes. Well, like all stretches, she was rather formidable, you know. She was a bit alarming. She was extraordinarily large. She looked at you through her glasses. But on the other hand, she was very kind. She was a very sympathetic person. More so, I think, when people... sometimes realise much more than the other Streeches, much more than Marjorie O'Powell. There's one of the letters I picked out to show you is a little note she wrote to Ida when my mother died, and it's really rather sweet, actually. It's very short, but it's straight from the heart, you know. It's very open, very warm.
Well, can you tell me about this Streechy? It's Streechy laugh, isn't it? So the Streechy voice, what is it? A high-pitched sort of laugh? What is distinctive about it?
But their mother, she was tremendously admired her and liked her very much.
Did she?
Yes. I never saw her, so I've no feelings about her one way or the other.
You obviously were right at the centre of all sorts of interesting things going on in the women's world at that time.
So I was. It was rather sad in one way that due to this, I mean, in a way she did it. She sort of cut her own throat over me in one way, because I think I had rather a revulsion from it all.
Yes, well, that quite often happens.
When I married my husband, when we were first married, he was very advanced in his views too and belonged to the Anglican Society for the Ordination of Women and that sort of thing. You know. And then one of the things that happened, of course, was the war. We were completely cut off because he was moved to Scotland and one just couldn't get down south to see. And then my aunt had died just before the war. And I had a sort of reaction against feminism altogether. I became terribly sort of absorbed in my own family, and I had babies, well, two rather quickly, then a miscarriage, and then two more abuses. And I had four little boys to look after, and no help, of course, on me. And I had to learn all the things. Actually, one thing is I must, this is due to, very much due to my aunt to say that because she was rather helpless and couldn't do things for herself in the domestic life, she had us taught certain things. She couldn't have us taught cooking because this Mrs. Mills, the cook housekeeper, wouldn't have allowed us into the kitchen. I mean, that was her domain and we just couldn't learn cooking. But we used to have to do things for ourselves which we very much disliked, like making our beds and waiting at table if she had visitors. You know. The other thing that she did was she employed a woman, a little dressmaker person, to teach us to sew and mend our clothes and look after our clothes. You know, I was grateful for that. Well, due to the fact that I've always been a very greedy person and my husband was quite greedy and my aunt was greedy, we all liked good food. When I say greedy, I don't think we any of us ate too much, but we very much enjoyed good food.
Yes, I see.
Good cooking. And to going abroad such a lot, you see, which made me interested in cooking as a kind of art. Mm-hmm. When I got married, I did learn to cook. I would have had to have done in the war anyway, but I was sort of interested enough to sort of start trying quite soon when I had my own kitchen, if I could do things in. I used to cook them. And then, of course, I just had to do everything.
It had all the excitement of the whole thing as well.
Yes, it had. It was different. But all this, you see, was a bit of a reaction. I mean, I did do a bit of intellectual stuff at the beginning. I mean, I coached a girl who never got through her exams. It wasn't much of a success. I sat on one or two committees in Hove, and I wrote some and the only money I ever earned in my life was I wrote articles for the Encyclopedia Britannica, who used to, not articles exactly, but people used to write to the Encyclopedia Britannica with sort of to do bits of research, and they found it out.
I see, yes.
And I remember that I used to go to the National Library of Scotland. And
well, it doesn't seem to me to be at all something to apologise for, the fact that in an age, if you're living in an age where there are no domestic servants, and where you have got four children, you can't live in the way in which you are.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's just a fact.
Unless
men change their whole attitude, the whole society is reorganised.
Yes, quite. Yes, well, you see, it's very funny. In some ways, I mean, she only lived to see my first child, who was a boy, and a bit of a disappointment to her. For being a boy. I mean, she soon got to love him for himself. He was a sweet little baby. Then I was going to have another just before she died, whom she decided was to be a girl. Of course, it wasn't, it was another boy. I only had boys. I didn't manage to get a girl.
So you've been a complete failure in that.
That's five pregnancies, all of which were male. Four of which were survived. Yes. She would have been a bit upset, I think, by the time the fourth boy arrived. She really felt rather bad about it. But the funny, what she would have pleased her, I mean, I think what would have pleased her very much indeed, were had she lived ever to see anything that is, would have been to see the sort of changed domestic pattern of the life of these sons of mine. Because I did have enough, still retain enough of the feminist atmosphere in which I'd grown up, the ambience, to feel that men ought not to be so helpless. You see, my husband was very helpless. I mean, he was like my aunt. He couldn't boil an egg either, or mend his clothes, or do anything except intellectual things. I remember he couldn't even mend fuses very competently. He did try to learn. The only thing he could do in the sort of practical line was he could drive a car and he chopped wood. But he couldn't mend the car if it broke down. I mean, he could change a wheel, but he couldn't do anything. Because he'd been brought up just that boys don't do those things. I mean, not because they had lots of sons, but because boys don't do those things.
So your sons were in a way rather in advance of their times, were they, because you...
Well, I taught them to cook. You see, I thought it was very unfair for them to make, because we had the four of them, and we it's true they all went to boarding schools, otherwise we couldn't have managed. With his work, it's so demanding, and I was swept into it, you see. But in the holidays, we used to make them. I used to make them do a lot of chores, and I always felt that if you're going to make people do chores like making their beds and all that, you must let them and washing up. You must let them do things which they quite enjoy. So I let them cook, and they all seemed quite interested in cooking. And they can all cook very competently. In fact, all do cook quite a lot, all four of them.
And of course, anyway, there is now a general pattern in that, which is going further, I think.
Yes, quite. Well, they also look after the children. I mean, one of them isn't married, but the other three are as able to look after even the baby as the mothers can. I mean, they can't feed it, but they can do it.
Yes. That's nice to think that's happened. But what about making a home? Was she good at making a comfortable sort of place for people to come to?
Oh, yes, she was, yes. She, mind you, I don't know how she would have managed it if she hadn't had these. I mean, I think Mrs. Mills must have been responsible for a very great deal of that in a way, of the comfort. But I'd admit that it's a spiritually comfortable place. I mean, you know, it was a welcoming. It was a house that people liked to come into.
With books in it?
Lots of books. Hundreds and hundreds of books. No music until I got interested in music at St. Paul's, because she was almost tone deaf. And there wasn't a piano in the house, but the artist, Janet Robertson, who was a miniature painter, did mostly children, who had this room as a studio, had a pianola.
Okay.
With rails, you know. And she used to play for us, my sister and I used to dance. We really loved listening to music, but Ida was more or less tone deaf. Then when I went to just before I went to schools, actually, when I was going to a day prep school in Hampshire, Hampstead, walking up Hampstead Hill, a German music teacher there, I said I wanted to learn the piano. You know, I was keen on singing and I wanted to learn the piano. And she said, yes, by all means, we'll somehow find the money. And so I had some music lessons, and this teacher took me to some concerts. She was very interested in me. So I just began to be interested in music and when I went to St. Paul's, and then of course I got swept up into the whole story of St. Paul's. Just made the whole difference to my life. And after that, we got a gramophone and we had a wireless with crystal and cat's whiskers, you know. And when I was in the house, there would be a lot of music.
Because Eva Hammock also is quite caught up in that because of Morley College. Tippett was
yes.
There, and I mean, there was quite a house to go as well.
Yes, he taught at Warwick College, yes, he did, and Imogen, both of them.
Yes. What about artisticness? I mean, was she artistic?
Yes, she was very keen on looking at paintings, and when we went abroad, she loved scenery and walking, and she had a great feeling of natural beauty, but also she was very keen on pictures and you know, she would take me to the National Gallery and we would look at pictures, and whenever we went, if we stayed anywhere, on our way to places, we would sometimes spend a night in Paris or something, and we'd always dash around to the Louvre or somewhere, you know. And she took up me to plays too. She took me to the Old Vic, because it was so cheap then, you know, and we used to go in the Upper Circle, and on Saturday afternoons, we'd sometimes go through a whole lot of Shakespeare plays on the tour. It wasn't only reading books, but she might have been quite good at drawing, really, but she never persevered with it, you know, don't quite know why. Because her Uncle Edward was a beautiful sketcher. I mean, he used to do watercolour sketches. And he had a younger brother who did those paintings. He was almost a professional.
What about things in the home? Did she have artistic china or paintings?
Oh, beautiful things in the home. You see, all these things come from that and that cabinet in there. I mean, my grandparents were very, very cultured people, and they would pick up things whenever they, from being abroad. And it was a very beautiful, her drawing room was a beautiful room. I mean, I have a lot of things like that. That a pink carpet, which is now almost threadbare, was the drawing room carpet, and I can't part with it even until it actually gets old.
Well, I don't think you should.
No, it's so lovely. I mean, you know, it's sort of delicate paper. We had sort of faded Liberty curtains, which were really lovely, went on for years and years and years and years.
What about dress?
She was quite interested in dress. When she'd been young, I think she dressed rather well. And she used to take a lot of trouble over trying to dress us to look pretty and be at the same time cheap, you know.
So she wasn't what Barbara would call an equal woman, that is, somebody who just dressed masculinely or in a...
Not a bit. No, not at all, no. She didn't spend much on her own clothes, and so she was apt to be pretty shabby. But for a great occasion, like, for instance, I remember she took an enormous amount of trouble over the dress she was going to wear at my wedding. And she took trouble with, as I say, with us, to have us things. She had very decided ideas. I mean, she didn't, for instance, she hated it when I first started wearing makeup. She didn't actually stop me, but she used to say things like, you know, you look so much prettier. Because I just wanted to be like my friend.
Of course.
I had
she never wore makeup then.
Never. She had a thing called, she had papier poudre, which Victorian ladies used to put on to prevent their noses being shiny, which was a little bit of paper, sort of impregnated with slightly pinkish powder, you know. And you were allowed to do that because it was rather indelicate to be sort of, actually sweating or... She used to be there, but she never had her hair done, you see, at a shop, ever. We only had ours done when we were still having it short. We had it cut from time to time, but it was always washed just in the bath or something. She had some rather beautiful pieces of Victorian jewellery, which occasionally she used to wear, but if she was dressed up for a great occasion, you know. But there weren't, we didn't go to parties much. We didn't have except if the Joneses were having parties, you know, around about and Aunt Mary were living there, and she would give parties for her sort of younger generation relations, you know, and we would go to those, and then she would dress up in what she had, you know, the best she had. She had quite a feeling, actually, for dress. I mean, one or two of the letters have quite... that's another thing she had in common with Charlotte Young, I think. She was unworldly, but she quite liked good clothes.
Did she... she wasn't austere with herself, though, you wouldn't say. I mean, she didn't sort of deny herself a lot, particularly. I mean...
I think only on religious grounds and simply in order to economise, she probably denied herself things that she would have liked, but she didn't take any sort of... I mean, for instance, when people gave her... I think she didn't... she didn't buy wine, you see, because she couldn't afford it. But when we went abroad, where it was terribly cheap, we would always have wine, because she liked wine. And she did smoke. Very moderately, yes, but she did smoke. She went on smoking all her life, I think. And I think every now and then, I think she would sort of, even about her religious things, she wasn't very hot on fasting. I mean, in spite of being very high church. Her church height changed, you see, after she went to live in Hampstead and got more involved in Maud Boyle, and then with Percy Dearmer, we all started going to St. Mary's Primary School, and this was in fact where I met my husband, and that was a church. She liked that, because you see, both Percy Dearmer and after him, Duncan Jones, though to a lesser extent, were very advanced in their views. I mean, they were quite feminist, and they had very liberal doctrine there, you know, and that she appreciated. She thought that was good.
I see. So, I mean, as far as religion, is religion really important in her life?
Very important, I think, yes. Oddly enough, she was very anti-religion as a growing up young woman, and there are some quite cutting letters about parsons and things, you know. And then after she became converted, it became a real mainspring. I think if you can tell, I think, from the way she writes about Florence Nightingale's in that book.
I haven't actually read it. So
oh, you haven't?
I've got it.
Oh, yes. Well, when you do read it, I think you'll see that coming out, because she had, I mean, it's a great contrast, really, to Mrs. Woodham Smith's biography. She enters into that part of Florence's life in, I think, a much more... Yes, by the way, about that, we may as well get the facts absolutely straight about Florence Nightingale. Mrs. Woodham Smith, against whom I have a great grudge, so I may say I'm speaking totally prejudiced and unjustly probably, makes out, more or less, that she was the only person who ever had access to the complete record of papers and things of the Nightingales, you know. Well, that's not strictly true, because in fact, my aunt was asked by the Nightingales to write the biography after Little Strachey, as eminent Victorian artist,
oh, yeah,
and then followed by a play called The Lady with the Lamp, which offended the Nightingale family very much, because it was intensely popular. And after those two things, they got very het up about all this, and they've been sitting on enormous great deal of papers, because Florence Nightingale was one of those people who writes down everything they think, you know, and has little jottings. And they decided that they'd better do something about it, and there was a kind of split in the family between the ones who wanted to burn everything, keep it all, because it was all too private and too intimate, you know, all her religious writing and musings and so on, and of course things about her sister. In the end, I did get, you know, we had a great packet full of letters and things, and I should say that her life, for the early part, she has the complete documents. The only things she hasn't got were the Verney papers, you see, so that maybe that makes her give a rather one-sided view of Parthy, because she hasn't got
so much. She put a lot of work into that.
But she, oh, it was tremendously well researched, yes. And you'll find it's a very good book. It's most lively and vivid. And
that must have caused a certain amount of embarrassment, did it? Because presumably Pippa and the Strachey's are pro-litter, aren't they, in their view? I don't know whether maybe that's too crude, but I
mean... No, I don't think so. I mean, the strange is, I don't think Pippa minded a bit. I mean, I think she thought that... you see, I don't think they thought they took Litton's... they didn't have the same sort of thing about because Litton had said it, it must be right.
No, because they're very independent.
They're very independent.
They're
very independent.
They always say what they think.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, they haven't got this. No, I don't think that caused any difficulty at all. No, I think her friends appreciated it very much. And then, you see, she had been collecting this material on for Women's Objection book in the interval when she had time to do any writing. And I think she really rather... I think in a way she rather didn't want to tackle the part after the Crimea because it was partly because there was too much documentation and partly because it didn't appeal to her so much. I mean, there's all this business with the War Office and the Indian Army and so on. There's so much administration and she would get wading through such masses and masses of War Office papers and things like that, you know, which was going to be terribly hard work.
Could I ask you a bit about study? Did she have a study of her own then in the house?
No, she didn't. She worked in the sitting room. But we had another room downstairs, which had been the servants' hall. So the drawing room, although it was always called the drawing room, was really her study. And I mean, but she did also entertain people in it. I mean, it was apt to be full of boxes of papers and things, but it was a pretty big room.
But would you be shut out for certain times of day while she did her writing?
Well, you see, we were at school all day.
Yes.
And I mean, if she was busy, she would say so, and we would play downstairs, and that was quite understood.
She didn't become in any way obsessive about her writing? Or
no, she didn't. I think she very seldom did much work in the evening. I think she tended to work during the day. And as she didn't have any domestic chores at all to do, you see, it gave her quite a long day, really.
Yes.
And by the evening, you see, I came back from school quite late because it was a long journey over to Hammersmith. It was 3/4 of an hour. And
presumably by that North London line you went, did you?
Well, I went by bus, actually.
Oh,
I went by 31 bus to Kensington and then changed and got a bus to Holland.
Yes.
I don't think there was any difficulty about that. And in the holidays, we would know to leave her in peace to write when she was busy. And we were all usually pretty busy. As I say, we had this the downstairs room, which was the dining room, was well, and it was our room to play in and do our things in, you know. And you just had to clear up your stuff when there was a meal going to be served. Well, I mean, this was common myth. We didn't have an absolute room of our own. Well, we had our bedroom, but that was not laid out. But later on, when I was working quite hard for exams and things at school, she did reorganize the sleeping accommodation upstairs so that I had a sort of bed sitting room because I had one which I couldn't work in.
She believed in you having a room of your own, did she?
She did, really, yes. I mean, a good deal of the time I had. At first I had to share with my sister, and then when I was really working, then she decided not to ever to have a spare room, and not just that she couldn't ever have people to stay in. So then there was a little room, quite a small room, which my sister had, and I had a fairly large room, which was which did have a desk in it, you know, or a table to write at, and I could have a gas fire on.
What about discipline, Mrs. Dunlop? I mean, was she at all disciplinarian? I mean, was she strict with you, really, do you think?
Well, only to the extent that her expectations are very high. She was
yes.
very wounded if one didn't live up to them.
Yes, it was that type of discipline.
We were hardly ever punished. I don't remember being punished except by her distress, you know.
Yes.
That's pretty grueling sometimes. Sometimes I would rather have had someone who'd just give you a quick slap and forget about it.
And what would it be? There'd just be an air of disapproval around, would there? Which
yes.
Would perfectly clear.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, I see. Yes. You really are bringing her very much to life. I mean, she's been, as I say, a name with certain formal attachments.
Yes.
Did she have a good sense of humour?
Yes, she did. Now, Martin side. I mean, she did have a good sense of humour, and although I suppose there were certain areas that she probably... Now, I think really we could laugh at almost anything now, provided you're close to her, you know. And she wouldn't sort of... she'd like jokes about things which might possibly wound people's susceptibilities, or... And she didn't like any kind of smut or anything like that, of course, you know. That, well, yeah. She just thought that was rather degrading and stupid, you know. But she had the sort of sense of humour that, I mean, we did have a great many sort of family jokes, and also that she could laugh at situations in which she was involved. I mean, you know.
Laughed herself.
And laughed herself, yes. And we used to get the giggles very often. I mean, all of us basically were laughing so much, we'd practically cry. We also cried a lot too, because I mean, this was I was always very bad about crying, and she never minded you showing emotion. You know, she was sorry that for me in a way, because I couldn't control it. It was very awkward at school and that, you know, people didn't like it. But there have been occasions where we've been sort of really loud and we've all had to put down the book going off to the we'll burst into tears. Well, this still happens in my family sometimes.
But really, when you say religion was important, how was it? She went to church every Sunday, did she?
Well, it wasn't so much the practice of it, in a way. I mean, some people would have said she was fairly lax. I mean, there was always, if you weren't very well or you were very tired or that, she didn't really think actually going to church so terribly important. But she thought a great deal about God and referred everything to God, I mean, you know, and would write very freely as people of that generation did, and with people don't so much now, about, you know, one's duty to God and God's expectations and all that sort of thing, you know, and everything that you did wrong and anything was referred to religion. I mean, it wasn't just breaking the rules, it was doing something that was against God's plan, you know. But on the other hand, she had very liberal doctrine. I mean, she thought that a lot of the doctrines of the church couldn't possibly be true, because she just didn't think God could possibly be like that, you know.
Meaning there was too inhumane, you mean?
Yes, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, presumably quite a lot of the evangelicalism, two generations back, is coming out through her in different ways. I mean, the serious-minded side of her.
Yes, I think that's probably true. I think that's true, and I think that, but it was sort of balanced against the sort of passion for social justice and so on, the sort of feeling that a great deal of, I mean, she didn't like the establishment anyway, the sort of ecclesiastical establishment, simply because she thought it was illiberal, inhumane, the doctrine, and anti-women, you see, very much. I mean, she greatly disliked the whole sort of attitude of the church towards women.
Did she? And she was really a follower of Mordroyd on that.
Oh, very much so, yes. And she would never have, for instance, I mean, one of the things, although she liked the trappings of Catholicism, she liked religion to be, have a good deal of pageantry, and in that way she was anti-evangelical. I mean, you know, she liked plenty of going on and incense and all that sort of thing, you know, the senses, she liked that part of it.
Yes.
But at the same time, she would never have been able to be a Roman Catholic, because she couldn't, because she had the contrary belief in the validity of the individual conscience. I mean, she could never have surrendered her conscience to anyone.
Mordroyd is a friend, is she, to the extent that she quite often drops in, and they see quite often each other?
Well, she was very busy. It was more apt to be more that we would go and see her, I think, you know, we'd go along there. But, I mean, they were, at one time, they'd been very, very close, I think. And then, I don't really know quite why, for some reason, rather they got a bit further apart. But then
she
was still
go
kept
to
up.
That place in
she went sometimes. I never went.
Did she?
Yes. Yes, she would go and hear Maud preach. And she had all her books.
Did she really?
Yes, and read them.
Because you see, one of the interesting things, which I'm sure you'll agree with me on, is that anyone of your generation and earlier, will, more Mordroidal really mean something to them.
Yes.
But now, I don't think anyone's heard of it. Yeah. I mean, all the correspondence in the press and so on about women priests and so on, Mordroidal's name is never mentioned in that.
No, no, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
Now, why, what's the root of her influence? Why did she have such a tremendous influence at the time? Was it this marvellous speaking voice she had?
It was partly her marvellous voice and her tremendous eloquence. I mean, she had a beautiful command of the language as well as a wonderful way of putting it across. And she had these luminous, shining eyes. You know, she was fascinating to watch when she was preaching. She gave, I mean, she was rather like the Delphic Sibyl. I mean, she gave it a sort of feeling it's coming from somewhere else. And also, she had in some ways, Maud Royden had the same gift that C.S. Lewis had at a later stage. She could put across things to people in a sort of slightly original and very convincing sort of way.
A direct sort of simple
yes,
way.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes.
But this has only just occurred to me, as a matter of fact, I hadn't really thought of it before. It suddenly struck me in thinking over her writings and so on that in some ways they sort of slightly remind me of C.S. Lewis.
Did she dress for the part? I mean, she was lame, in fact, wasn't she?
She was very lame, yes. She used to wear a little sort of square cap, rather like a beretta, but not quite. You know, it was sort of halfway between a beretta and an Oxford women's
yes.
cap, you know. Mm. And a long sort of cassock. She never wore surplices or anything more fancy than that. She wore a sort of dress that looked rather like a cassock, you know, sort of dark blue.
But Ida's